document. Mike, can I call you Mike? You need to understand that everything has changed here in the last couple of years. Yes, the proposed development falls within the envelope of what is considered acceptable, but there are other considerations we now have to take into account. Like, how are you going to minimise the environmental impact? You've not yet given me a reassuring answer. This area has a growing awareness of its whale and dolphin population, and people around here don't want to do anything to harm them. On a purely economic level, they're a growing tourist attraction in themselves. We're not like the pearl fishery. We wouldn't be marking off huge areas of the waterfront, I said. But you'd still be making some of it unusable. It would only be with the same activities that tourists normally take part in, nothing large-scale or controversial. But that's it. We don't get those kind of tourists round here. Not in Silver Bay, anyway. They might swim, paddle out in a dinghy, but wet bikes, jet or water skiing are much noisier, much more intrusive. Mr. Riley, you know as well as I do that in a place like this, development is only a matter of time. If it's not us, it'll be some other corporation. He put down his pen and looked at me with a mixture of belligerence and sympathy. Look, mate, we're all for development around here. Anything that will help the local community. We know we need the employment and the infrastructure. But our sea creatures, our wildlife, are not an afterthought. We're not like European cities. Build first, worry about the environment later. We don't separate the two. And you won't win over this town unless you can sort out the environmental stuff. That's fine, Mr. Riley, I said, pulling my papers together. Very commendable. But I'd have more sympathy with your argument if this week I hadn't watched two whales bullied half to death by tourists in disco boats, which didn't seem to be policed by anyone in your area. It's all very well for you to tell me that my development's going to have a negative impact, but the threat to the whales is already out there, far worse than anything we're proposing, and as far as I can see, no one is doing anything about it. What we're suggesting is a limited development. We're willing to be as sympathetic as we can be to environmental concerns, to take expert advice and to be licensed if necessary. But you can't tell me your area's a model for environmental excellence because I saw that dead baby whale, saw what prompted its death. I've been out whale watching, and I hate to say it, that's an intrusion in itself. You don't know that. And you don't know whether a few water skiers are really going to affect a whale migration that's gone on for centuries. There's got to be consistency about this. I'll discuss it, he said. But don't be surprised if it goes to a public inquiry. People are getting wind of these plans, and a few are already antsy. I had arrived home in a foul mood and rung Dennis. Perversely glad when I worked out the time difference and discovered how long he had been asleep. After I'd outlined the results of my meeting, I was disconcerted to find that he could spring into life from a deep sleep with virtually no sluggish in between. It was as if he had been processing it all as he slept. It's complicated, Dennis. I can't pretend it's not. But I've had a radical thought. What if we shut down the water sports angle, made it more of a spa experience? We could really go for it, make it a Vogue-type thing, where celebrities go. But the water sports are its bloody unique selling point, Dennis barked. That's why the venture capitalists are interested. It's meant to be about sport, about keep fit. It's about a total body experience, targeting men as much as women. A luxury leisure experience. Is this the bloody whale crusties again? What have they said? They've not said anything. They still don't know. So what's your bloody problem? I want this to work on all levels. You're not making sense. Dennis, we'd have a lot easier ride from the planners if there was no risk of anything happening to the sea creatures. We'd have a lot easier ride from the planners if you did your job properly and stressed what a fantastic opportunity it is for a depressed area, how much money everyone stands to make. It's not just about money. It's always about money. Okay. But it's just that when you're out here, you also get a sense of the... I ran a hand through my hair. The importance of the whales. There was a pause before he spoke again. The importance of the whales. I braced myself. Mike, this is not what I expect to hear from you. This is not what I promoted you for. This is not what I want to hear when I'm stuck on my ass in England waiting for news of a £130 million luxury hotel development that you've still not secured the planning permission for, even though you've been in Australia 3 weeks. Now, we need the permissions secured, and we need them super fast. We have to start building in a matter of months. So, you talk to your bloody crusty whale friends and go sing your whale song, throw some money at Mr. Riley, or get his picture taken with some Lithuanian lap dancer, whatever it takes, but come back to me in the next 48 hours with a concrete plan I can present to Valence Equity when they turn up on Monday. Okay? Or the whales won't be the only things blubbering. He took a deep, shaking breath. I was glad that so many thousands of miles separated us. Look, you wanted to be a partner. Prove you're up to it. Or, even though I love you like a son, you may find your ass imprinted with my metaphorical left boot, along with your employment prospects. You get me? It certainly didn't need spelling out any more clearly than that. I sat back in my chair, shut my eyes and thought about everything I'd worked for over the past years, everything I'd look forward to becoming. Then I thought of what Hannah had told me about her school bus. The lack of a library. Okay, I said. There's one possible way through this. Do you remember me mentioning a thing called an S-94? As Mr. Riley had explained it to me, it worked like this. For every tourist development in the Silver Bay area, the council generally expected a 50% financial contribution from the developers towards the extra strain on local services: roads, car parking, recreational facilities, firefighting, and emergency services, that kind of thing. It was not unfamiliar to me. We had come across similar provisions in other developments, and I had found there was usually some clause, as there was in the case of Silver Bay, that allowed for a waiver if the development was deemed of sufficient benefit to the community. I had usually wangled it on the basis of my research. Dennis had also achieved it, but hinted at palms being greased and companies receiving lucrative building contracts. More than one way to skin a cat, he liked to say, smacking his hands together. And everyone had their price. The council document was a thorough piece of research, detailing not just the population projection for the area, but the cost of all the amenities likely to be needed to accommodate it. I began to plough through them, calculating the cost to our development, trying to highlight those that would have the most favourable impact on the public. Continuing growth in the development of tourist accommodation, which is occurring over the whole council area, as well as the traditional coastal fringe, will create an increase in demand for the provision of council facilities. The level of demand on the facilities varies with the category and stay time at the tourist accommodation provided, but there is an increase in demand over that of the permanent population. I had sat up staring at the paper, thinking. But studying the S-94 document, I had seen that we could turn this one on its head. What if our company offered over and above the contribution level and brought with it, for example, a new library for the Silver Bay School, or a new school bus, or a regeneration of the Whale Chasers Museum? During our meeting, Mr. Riley had worn the expression of a man well used to hearing it all before. He had probably had many such approaches over the years, and turned down as many as he had approved. But Beaker Holdings would not, like most developers, try to provide the minimum material public benefit to build its resort. Instead, it would show itself to be a model for responsible development. It would provide over and above what was needed. It would be generous and imaginative, and, with luck, we could use this development as a model for the next. It is fair to say that local government projected spending does not generally make the most exciting reading in the world, but that afternoon, before Hannah had come upstairs and disturbed me, I had been as excited by a municipal financial document as it's possible to be. Vanessa slept till after 11 the next morning. I lay beside her for some time after daybreak, glancing at her face, watched her shifting unconsciously under the sheet. Eventually, when my thoughts became too complicated, I got out of bed without waking her. Sometime after 7:30, I crept downstairs, let myself out, and ran 5 miles along the coast road and back, enjoying the damp chill of the morning air, the sense of quiet and isolation that only running provides. I ran longer and harder than I generally do, shedding layers of clothing as I went, but did not feel noticeably more exhausted. I needed the physical effort, the time to think. As I ran along the dirt track that split the pavement from the beach, I pictured the new resort, perhaps some low-cost housing to accommodate the staff. Australia, I had discovered, had the same problem as England with housing affordability. Perhaps we could offer some water sports-related shops and cafes. Maybe, if the returns were great enough, a medical centre. As I headed back, I tried not to look at the Silver Bay Hotel. If the development were to go ahead, it would be at best overshadowed, at worst, demolished. Twice, people whose faces I now recognised, dog walkers, fishermen, lifted a hand in greeting, and as I waved back, I wondered what they would think of my plans. To them I was not the English stranger, the fish out of water, the proposed fiancé, the sticky beak, the thief of other men's women. As I ran through a list of urgent phone calls I had to make, to Dennis, to the financial department, to Mr. Riley to arrange another meeting, I thought again about those waving people and asked myself, who the hell are they waving at? Somewhere along the Silver Bay Coast Road, I had had a revelation. For months I had been obsessed with this development, had thought about it only in terms of what it meant to my career and my company. Now I had been confronted with the potential cost, and I saw that my first concerns were no longer money and ambition, but something infinitely more difficult. Successful compromise. I wanted Kathleen and Liza to be as happy with this outcome as the flint-eyed venture capitalists. I wanted the whales and dolphins to continue their lives unaffected by it, or at least as unaffected by it as any creature can be when it lives in close proximity to man. I hadn't worked it out yet, but with my head full of conservation areas and commemorative museums, I felt I might at last be grasping towards something. I returned at 8:30, wet with sweat, brain numbed with effort, half hoping I could fetch myself breakfast without bumping into anyone. I had timed my return, I am ashamed to say, to coincide with Liza and Hannah's school run, and it was my best chance of finding an empty house. But Kathleen was still sitting at the kitchen table, her own breakfast long finished, her grey hair tied back and a dark blue sweater announcing the arrival of winter. She had set me a place with coffee and cereal. Another place setting sat ostentatiously beside it.
"Kept that one quiet?"
she observed from behind her newspaper as I sat down. How could I tell her it was as if I had forgotten? 12. Greg. You'd never have noticed the scar on Liza McCullen's face if you hadn't been right up close to her, never run your hand down her cheek and pushed her hair behind her ear. It was pretty faded now, a good few years old, I reckoned. About an inch and a half of slightly raised pearl-white skin, a little jaggedy as if she'd never had it fixed up properly when she hurt herself. Half the time she wore her old baseball cap so that that part of her face was always in shadow. When the hat was off, her hair was always in strands round her face, whipped by the wind out of her ponytail. When she laughed, you could barely notice it because of the creases the sea and the sun had blown into the corners of her eyes. But I saw it. And even without the scar, you'd have known there was something a bit off-key about Liza. The first time I met her, she was like a ghost. This may sound a bit fancy, but I swear that you could almost see through her. She was like sea mist, like she wanted to vaporise into air. "This is my niece," said Kathleen, as we all waited for our beer one afternoon, like that was all that would be said about the arrival of someone most of us had never even heard existed. "And this is her daughter Hannah, from England. They'll be staying." I said g'day. A couple of the other whale chasers echoed me, and Liza nodded this weird hello, not looking anyone in the eye. She was about as done in by jet lag as it's possible to be. I'd seen the kid a couple of days before, hanging on to Kathleen's hand, and I'd guess she belonged to one of the guests. It was a bit of a shock to discover not just that she was Kathleen's family, but that someone else had been there all along. I checked her out a little. She was blonde and leggy, just my type. But there was nothing much to her then. She was pale with big old dark circles round her eyes and her hair hanging in curtains round her face. I was more curious than, you know, interested. But Hannah. I loved Hannah the moment I saw her, and I'm pretty sure she liked me too. She stood there, tucked behind Kathleen with those big brown eyes as wide as a possum's, and she looked like if anyone said boo to her, she'd fall over and die of fright. So I knelt right down. She was a tiny kid then, and I said, "G'day, Hannah. Did your Auntie Kathleen tell you what's right outside your room?" Kathleen looked sharp at me like I was about to say the bogeyman or something. I ignored her and carried on. "Dolphins. In the water out there in the bay. Smartest, most playful creatures you can imagine. If you look hard enough out of your window, I bet you'll see them. And you know what? They're that smart, they'll probably stick a nose up to check you out too." "The bay's full of them," said Kathleen. "You ever seen a dolphin up close?" She shook her little head, but I had her attention. "Beautiful they are. They play with us when we take the boats out, jump around, swim underneath, just as clever as you or me. Nosy, but they'll come and see what we're doing. There's pods of them that have lived in this bay 30-40 years. Isn't that right, Kathleen?" The old lady nodded. "If you want, I'll take you out to see them," I said. "No," came a voice. I stood up. Kathleen's niece had come to life. "No," she said, her jaw set tight. "She can't go out on the water." "I'm as safe as houses," I said. "You ask Kathleen. Been doing dolphin tours for nearly 15 years. Hell, me and the Mobys are the longest-running operators here next to Kathleen. And the kids always wear life jackets. You tell her, Kathleen." But Kathleen didn't seem quite like herself. "Everyone needs a little time to settle in. Then we'll think about nice things for Hannah to do. There's no rush." There was a weird silence, Liza was staring at me as if daring me to suggest any other trips. It was as if I'd suggested doing something terrible to the little girl. Kathleen smiled at me like an apology. She seemed about as out of her depth as I'd ever seen her. I'm a simple bloke, not the kind to dig my way into a mess. I decided to make it an early night with the missus. That, of course, was in the days before she was out giving it up to her keep-fit instructor. "Good to meet you, Hannah. You keep an eye out for those dolphins now," I said to her, tipping my cap, and she gave me a little smile that wiped out everything else around me. Liza McCullen already seemed to have forgotten I was there. "Hey, Greggy, you seen this?" I was sitting in McIver's Seafood Bar and Grill, a 5-minute walk up the path from Whale Jetty, trying to shift my sore head with a pie and a coffee. I figured it might work as a cross between breakfast, which I had missed, and lunch, which I rarely ate. It had hardly been worth going home. I had left the bar after a lock-in with Dell, the owner, sometime after 2 that morning, and virtually retraced my footsteps there as soon as I could get myself out of the shower. The bar was quiet, the sun still casting long shadows over the bay, the stiff winter breeze keeping what remained of the tourist away from the front, so we walked over and sat down, shoving the newspaper towards me across the table. "What?" I was having trouble focusing. "The front page. About this big old development in Silver Bay." "What are you talking about?" I squinted, pulled the paper towards me and scanned the front page story under the headline, "Major Tourist Boost for Town." It said that a multi-million dollar development had been approved for the land along the bay from Kathleen's. A major international corporation had got planning permission for the development after an unprecedented series of offers to safeguard the nature of the town and the sea life around it. Valence Equity, the financiers behind the plan, have put forward a proposal that includes a new Museum of Whales to raise awareness of Port Stephens sea creatures among tourists, whale-friendly water sports, with all instruction including whale safeguards, and a series of add-on benefits including funding for a new library and a school bus for Silver Bay Elementary School. We're hoping that this is just the beginning of a fruitful partnership with the local community, said Dennis Beaker of Beaker Holdings, one of the British-based developers. We want to take the relationship further to provide a benchmark for responsible building in the area. Mayor of Silver Bay, Don Brown, said, "We deliberated long and hard about the appropriateness of this development, but after a lengthy planning process, we are happy to welcome both the employment and infrastructure benefits that the new hotel complex will bring. But most of all, we welcome the company's responsible and thoughtful attitude towards our waters." "And the sizable backhander I've got stuffed in my back pocket," mocked Dell. "Kathleen know about this?" "Dunno, mate. I've not been down there for a few days." "Well," said Dell, "I guess she'll know now." He slung his tea towel over his shoulder and waddled back towards the grill where a burger was sending sparks up into the extractor fan. "Whale-friendly water sports," I said. "What the Sam Hill are whale-friendly water sports?"
"Perhaps they're going to teach them synchronized swimming," Dell chuckled, "or train them to pull water skiers."
My brain had started to clear. "This is a bloody disaster," I said, reading on. "They've bought up the old Bullen place and the water around it." Dell said nothing, flipping his burgers. I kept reading. "We'll need permission to get the boats out next.
I can't believe what I'm seeing.
Greg, you can't say the town doesn't need the business.
You reckon?
I suddenly saw the bar and grill through the eyes of a visitor. The linoleum had been unchanged for the 15 years I had lived in Silver Bay, the tables and chairs more comfortable than stylish, but that was how we liked it, how I liked it. Later, I walked down to the ticket booth. Leonie, a student, was manning it for the winter. You could usually find some dolphin-mad teenager to work there for a pittance.
"You got 4 this afternoon," she said, waving a docket. "A family of 6 for Wednesday morning and a 2 for Friday, but I've told them I have to confirm that because the forecast's not so good."
I nodded, barely seeing her.
"Oh, Greg," she said, "Liza's coming up this arvo. She wants to talk to you and all the other guys about this development thing. I think she's a bit worried."
"She's not the only one," I said. I lit a tab and went to sit in my truck. The first time Liza McCullen and I went to bed, she was so drunk that to this day I'm not sure that she remembered afterwards what we'd done at all. It was about a year after she'd got here. She'd warmed up a bit, less a tropical warmth and a kind of Arctic thaw, I always say. But she was still pretty cool with everyone. Not a great one for conversation. She'd started going out with Kathleen on Ishmael. Kathleen was showing her the ropes while the little one was at school, and the more time she spent on the water, the happier she got. I made a few jokes about her being competition and all, but Kathleen gave me the eye until I made some shark lady crack. Then she'd ask me why I couldn't go and spend my measly dollars in some other bar. I think she was joking. By then, Liza would talk to me a bit. She'd sit out some nights with me and the other whale chasers. Ned Durrican and that French girl with the moustache were running Moby too, and chat a little. Hi, yes, or thank you. It was like getting blood out of a stone. I used to crack jokes at her all the time. By then she'd kind of got to me. I like to make a girl laugh. It bugged me that some nights I could barely raise a smile. I'd been working on her so hard that, well, if I'm truthful, it was probably about that time that Suzanne got fed up. I'd stay all night outside Kathleen's, sinking a few, and before you knew it, I'd be home half-cut, and Suzanne would be sitting there with a face like a smacked ass, the dinner so charred you could have drawn pictures with it. But that night you could tell something was different. Liza hadn't come out, and Kathleen was tight-lipped and said she was staying in the house. So I went in and sat down where I found her in the kitchen. I didn't say anything about the fact that she was checking out some photograph because when I came in she shoved it into her jacket pocket, like she didn't want anyone to see, and her eyes were all red like she'd been crying. For once in my life I managed to keep my big gob shut because I had a feeling like something was different, and if I was careful it might work to my advantage. Then, after she'd sat there for a few minutes and I'd tried not to shift about on my chair, I've hated sitting still since I was a nipper, she looked up at me, her big eyes so sad they made even me want to weep, and said, "Greg, will you help me get drunk? I mean, really drunk." "Well, now," I said. I slapped my knees. "No man more qualified in the whole of Silver Bay." Without a word to Kathleen, we walked down the track, got into my truck and drove to Dell's, where she sat and knocked back Jim Beam like it was going out of fashion. We left after the bar shut, and by this stage she was so far gone she could barely stand. She was not a silly drunk like Suzanne, who would sing and get fresh, which, I'd tell her, just wasn't pretty in a woman, or even an angry drunk. She acted like whatever was getting to her was eating at her from the inside.
"Not drunk enough,"
she mumbled as I shoved her into the truck.
Need some more drink.
The bars are shut now, I said. I don't think there's one open this side of Newcastle.
I'd had a few myself, but there's something about watching someone who's really out to sink them that puts you off getting too drunk.
Kathleen's, she said. We'll go back and drink at Kathleen's.
I didn't imagine the old shark lady would be too happy at the thought of us raiding her bar in the small hours, but hell, it wasn't my decision. It was still hot enough that your clothes stuck to you and we sat outside with our beer. In the moonlight I could see the sweat glistening on her skin. Everything felt odd that night, like the atmosphere was charged, like anything could happen. It was the kind of night where you get a sudden storm at sea. I listened to the waves breaking on the beach and the crickets and tried not to think about the girl next to me swigging hard at her beer. I remember that at some point we had taken our shoes off and it was someone's idea to go paddling. I remember her laughing so hysterically that I couldn't be sure if she was actually crying. And then, as she lost her balance under the jetty, she kind of fell against me, and I still remember the taste of her lips as she reached for mine. Jim Beam and desperation, I told myself. Not a pretty mix. Not that that stopped me. The second time was about 6 months later. Suzanne and I had split up for a while, and she was staying with a sister in Newcastle. Liza had got even more drunk and I'd had to hold back her hair while she was sick before she was together enough to come back in the truck. Didn't stop her finishing a bottle of Mr. Gaines' finest Shiraz at mine. She was a strange one, though. Stone cold sober every night of the week, but now and then it was as if she'd decided to knock herself out cold. That night I woke up in the small hours to find her weeping in bed beside me. She had her back to me, her shoulders were shaking and her hands over her face. "Did I hurt you?" I was half groggy with sleep. You don't like to find a girl weeping after you've given her one, you know what I mean. "Liza, what's the matter, love?" Then, as I touched her shoulder, I realised she was asleep. It freaked me out a little, so I called to her, then shook her.
"What?"
she said. And then, as she looked round the room,
"Oh, God, where am I?"
"You were crying," I said. "In your sleep. I thought it was me." She was already out of bed, reaching for her jeans. Honest, if I hadn't been so drunk myself, it would have been insulting.
Hey, hold your horses. You don't have to go anywhere. I just wanted to make sure you were okay."
I saw the white flash of her brassiere as she hooked it over her arms.
"It's nothing to do with you, Greg. I'm sorry, I've got to go."
She was like a man. She was like me when I used to go out on the lash before I met Suzanne and wake up with someone I'd have gnawed my arm off to get away from. 10 minutes after she'd left, I realised she didn't have her car. But by the time I got downstairs, she was long gone. I reckon she must have run halfway down the coast road to get home. She would do that, like she had no fear.
"Why should she?" said Kathleen cryptically when I asked. "The worst has already happened."
The next day, when I sat down beside her on the bench, she behaved like nothing had gone on. 4 more times she had done this to me. Not once had we been together when she was sober. If I was less of a looker, I reckon I'd have been a bit worried. I guess I should have got pissed off, but you couldn't with Liza. There was something about her. She was not like anyone else I knew. When she finally told me about the bub, she was sober. And she told me not to say a word. She wouldn't answer questions, didn't even tell me how the little one died. She just told me because I'd got mad and asked her point blank why the hell she had to get so drunk to go to bed with me. I don't get drunk to go to bed with you, she said. I get drunk to forget. Going to bed with you is a byproduct of that.
As straight as you like, as if none of it would hurt my feelings.
And don't go asking Hannah about it.
She looked like she regretted telling me already, which was a bit much.
I don't want you stirring things up. She doesn't need reminding.
Geez, you've got a poor opinion of me, I said.
No, I'm just careful.
She closed her hands into two tight fists.
These days, I'm just careful.
Dell was happy to host the meeting. He knew he'd get a few extra all-day brekkies out of it. But he'd told me straight beforehand that he didn't oppose the development. Sighted where he was, within a few feet of it, he said, wiping his hands on his apron, he stood to make a killing. Like the kind of clientele they were talking about would stop by an old grease bucket like McIver's for lunch. I knew I wasn't going to sway the old bugger, but I guessed correctly that guilt might make him good for a bacon roll, and as the time approached, I sat outside and ate it, washed down with a good strong coffee. I had put the word round, and a few local hotel owners, fishermen, the whale chasers, people who were likely to be affected by it all were coming. We sat and stood outside McIver's, waiting for people to straggle in. A few clutched copies of the newspaper. Some murmured to each other, while a few chatted normally, as if the town weren't about to be changed completely. I didn't talk to Liza when she got there, and she didn't seem in a hurry to talk to me. But I waved at Hannah, who came over and sat next to me. "Your boat's still in the lock-up," I said quietly, because I wanted to see her smile.
"Will all the dolphins move away?" she said.
Kathleen had arrived and put a hand on her shoulder. "I'm sure they've seen worse than this," she said. "In the war we had warships in the bay, bombers going overhead, submarines, but we still had dolphins. Don't you worry."
"They're smart, aren't they? They'll know to keep out of everyone's way."
"Smarter than most people round here," said Kathleen. I didn't like the way she looked sideways at me when she said that. Lance got up and began to speak. We'd agreed he'd be better at all that stuff. I was never one for public speaking, and we all knew Liza would have died rather than put her face about. He said he appreciated that the development would have some economic benefits for the town, but the water sports school would run the risk of destroying the town's one area for tourist growth, the whales and dolphins. "I appreciate a lot of you guys won't care one way or the other, but this is the one thing that marks out Silver Bay from a lot of the other destinations. And most of you will know that when the tourists come out on our boats, they'll often stop off in the cafes or shops on the way home. Or they'll stay in your hotels and motels." There was a murmur of agreement. "This thing is foreign money," he said. "Yes, there will be a few jobs, but you can bet your life the profits won't stick around in Silver Bay, not even in New South Wales. Foreign investment means returns to foreigners, and besides, we don't even know the full nature of this development. If it has its own cafes and bars, well, hell, you guys will lose as much as you gain."
"It might boost the winter trade, but," came a voice from the back. "At what cost? If the whales and dolphins go, there isn't going to be any winter trade," said Lance. "Be honest. How many people would come here in June, July, August if it wasn't for Whale Jetty, huh?"
There was silence. Beside me, Hannah was reading the newspaper. I swear that kid's getting so grown up it'll be two ticks before she's driving.
"Greg," she said, frowning.
"What is it, sweetheart?" I whispered. "You want me to get you something to eat?"
"That's Mike's company."
Her little finger was on a bit of the print.
Beaker Holdings. That's the one that has his picture on their website.
It took me a minute or two to work out what she was saying, and a little longer to work out what that meant. Beaker Holdings, I read. You sure, sweetheart?
I remembered it because it was like a bird beak. Does that mean Mike's bought Silver Bay?
I could barely see straight for the rest of that meeting. I just about held it together while Lance organised a petition. I managed to raise my hand when they voted to call up the planning guy and register a complaint. And then, as everyone drifted away, I asked Kathleen if she knew whether Mike was at the hotel.
He's in his room, she said. I think his girlfriend's gone shopping.
She sniffed.
She likes shopping.
She looked up at me.
Greg, you okay?
Can you get Liza? I said, trying to keep the edge from my voice in front of the little one.
There's something you need to know.
It took 18 months for me to get Liza McCullen into bed, and nearly 2 years more for her to trust me enough to tell me about her daughter. That was why I couldn't believe it when, the day after the whale calf died, I drove up to the hotel to bring her keys, which she'd left at mine in her usual hurry to get home. It's why I haven't been back to the hotel since, because the image still burnt in my imagination, tormented me no matter how many beers I poured down my throat. Her sitting in the car park of the Silver Bay Hotel soon after she'd got out of my bed, bold as brass, held tight in the arms of that Englishman. As it turned out, he was sitting in the kitchen, where only Kathleen's family ever goes, like he had some kind of rights over the place. When we appeared in the doorway, he looked up. He had been reading an old guidebook and was wearing a smart shirt. Just the sight of him in that space made me want to smack him. It took him a second or two to register, but Liza didn't give him any more than that. She slammed the newspaper onto the kitchen table.
That how you do your research, is it?
He looked at the headline and actually went white. I've never seen it happen before. But the colour ran out of him so fast that I almost found myself looking down in case a puddle of blood was leaking onto the floor.
Sit in our hotel for the best part of a month, making friends, asking questions, chatting up my daughter, and all the while you're planning to ruin us?
He stared at the front page.
Of all people! Of all people! Knowing what you knew, how could you, Mike? How could you do that?
By God, I've never seen her so mad. She was electric, fizzing. Her hair almost stood on end. He stood up.
Liza, let me explain. Explain? Explain what? That you came here pretending to be on holiday and all the while you've been plotting and planning with a bloody council to destroy us? It's not going to destroy you or the whales. I've been working on putting all these safeguards in place.
She laughed then, a hollow, crazy sound. I have to admit she was a little scary at this point.
Safeguards? Safeguards? How is a bloody water sports park bang in the middle of our waters any kind of safeguard? There'll be speedboats whizzing around pulling skiers, jet skis, you name it. Do you know what this is going to do to the whales? How is it worse than what you do? It's just boat engines. They'll know to steer clear of the migration path. There will be rules, advisories. Rules? What the hell do you know? You think an 18-year-old boy with a jet ski wants to talk about rules?
She was shaking with rage.
You watched us try to save that baby whale, and now you can stand there and say your bloody water sports park won't affect anything? Worse,
You got my daughter to tell you what was most needed so you could suck up to the planning department and win them over. I thought it might be something good, he protested. She said they were things they needed. They were things you needed to get the bloody planning department on your side. You're sick, you know that? Sick! It's not my decision, he said helplessly. I've been doing my best to make this thing work for everybody.
You've been doing your best to line your pockets, I said. I moved a step closer to him and I saw him square as if he were preparing himself for a blow. Liza turned back, tearful now. She shook her head and said bitterly,
You know, everything you said you were is a lie. Everything.
That was the first time he looked angry.
No, he said urgently, reaching out a hand. Not everything. I wanted to talk to you. I still want to talk to you, but...
She brushed him off as if he was toxic.
You really think there's anything you have to say that I'd want to hear? I'm sorry. I wanted to say something about the development, he continued, but I had to get it worked out first. Once I realized what the whales meant to you guys, I wanted to find a way to keep everyone happy. Well, congratulations,
she spat.
I hope you're happy, because this thing's going to destroy us, and it'll destroy the whales. But hey, as long as your investors get a good return, I'm glad you're happy.
I offered to hit him then.
Oh, don't be such a bloody fool, she said.
And with a dismissive wave that seemed to include both of us, she pushed past me and out of the kitchen. A girl was standing in the hallway, blonde with expensive clothes and a diddy little handbag held close to her chest. She stood back to let Liza pass.
Is everything okay?
She said. Another pom. This must be the girlfriend, I thought. Too good for the likes of him. I'll have you, mate, I said to him, pointing my finger into his face. Don't think any of this is going to be forgotten.
Oh, calm down, Greg,
said Kathleen wearily, and pushed me out of the kitchen.
Like it was my bloody fault. Like any of it was my bloody fault.
Vanessa, perhaps you'd like to come in and sit down. I'll make a pot of tea.
13. Kathleen. Newcastle Observer, the 11th of April 1939. The largest grey nurse shark ever caught in New South Wales has been landed in a fishing community north of Port Stephens by a 17-year-old girl. Miss Kathleen Whittier Mostyn, daughter of Angus Mostyn, proprietor of the Silver Bay Hotel, hauled in the creature on Wednesday afternoon, out in waters near Breaknose Island. She landed it unaided from a small sculling craft, while her father had briefly returned to the hotel to fetch some provisions. He said, I was genuinely shocked when Kathleen showed me her catch. The first thing we did was bring it into shore and call up the appropriate authorities, as it was my guess that she had broken some kind of record. A fisheries spokesman confirmed it was the largest shark of its kind ever netted in the area. This is a considerable achievement for a young lady, said Mr. Saul Thompson. The shark would have been difficult to land even by a proper game fisherman. The shark has already become a considerable attraction, with local game fishermen and sightseers travelling some distances to see the creature. Mr. Mostyn plans to have it mounted and placed in the hotel as a record of his daughter's estimable catch. We just have to find a wall strong enough, he joked. The hotel staff say bookings have trebled since news broke of Miss Mostyn's prize, and the record is sure to add to the area's growing reputation as a fine place for game fishing. I dusted the glass frame and put the yellowing newspaper cutting back against the wall, alongside the photographs of the stuffed shark. The taxidermy itself hadn't been particularly successful. I suspected my father had been in such a hurry to put it on show that he had not had it done by anyone of genuine skill. And the creature had fallen apart when it was moved from the hotel into the museum, stuffing oozing from the seams around the fins and along the joint of the tail. Eventually we admitted defeat and put it out with the bins. I watched out of the window with amusement on the day the bin men came. It didn't help that it had been handled by pretty much every visitor who ever walked in. There was something about a stuffed shark that made people want to touch it. Perhaps it was the frisson of knowing that in normal circumstances they wouldn't be that close to one without amputation or death following hard behind. Perhaps it gave them some strange sense of power. Perhaps we all harbour a perverse need to get close to things that might destroy us. I looked away deliberately from the photographs and ran the duster lightly over the other objects and curios, seeing the museum through the eyes of the kind of tourist who would be interested in a top-of-the-range water sports park, or, as the newspaper had put it, a proper museum of whales and dolphins. I had not had a visitor in 10 days. Perhaps I couldn't blame them, I thought, carefully placing a harpoon back on its hooks. This was increasingly less a museum than a bunch of old fish bones in a rackety shed. I was only keeping it going because of my father. They were all up at the hotel, sitting outside, loudly discussing their ideas to fight the planning decision over beer and chips. I hadn't wanted to be among them, didn't want to feign sympathy for as yet uncommitted crimes against free creatures of the sea. My own feelings, my own reservations, were quite different from theirs. I heard the door creak and turned. Mike Dormer was there. It was hard to see his face as he stood against the light. So I beckoned to him. "I haven't been in here before," he said, glancing around as his eyes adjusted to the darkness. His hands were shoved deep in his pockets, his normally straight-backed posture stooped and apologetic. "No," I agreed. "You haven't." He walked around slowly, staring up at the beams from which hung old lines, nets and buoys, whalers' overalls from the 1930s. He seemed interested in everything, in a way genuine visitors rarely were. "I recognise this picture," he said, stopping in front of the newspaper cutting. "Yes, well, one thing we do know about you, Mike, is that you certainly do your research." It came out harder than I'd intended, but I was tired, and I still felt unbalanced because I'd had him under my roof for so long, yet failed to get the measure of him. "I'm sorry," he said. "I deserve that." I sniffed and began to dust the souvenirs on the trestle table next to the old till. They seemed tacky and pathetic all of a sudden. Whale key rings, dolphins suspended in plastic balls, postcards, and tea towels featuring grinning sea creatures. Children's gifts. What was the point when no children came here anymore? "Look, Kathleen, I know you might not want to talk to me right now, but I do have to say something to you. It's important to me that you understand." "Oh, I understand, all right." "No, you don't. I wanted to say something," he said. "Really. I came out here expecting it to be a straightforward development job. I thought I'd be in and out, that I was building in an area that no one would be fussed about. Once I realised that wasn't the case, I was trying to work out a solution that would keep my boss happy in England and you lot happy out here. I needed to find out as much as I could. You could have shared that with us. We might have been able to contribute something. especially since I've lived in the area for 70-odd years. I know that now. I noted with a weird satisfaction that his shoes had become very scuffed. But once I got to know you all, it was impossible. "Especially Liza," I said. "Call it a wild guess." "Yes," he said. "Yes, and Liza." "Well, Mike, for a quiet man, you've made a big impact around here." I kept polishing, not sure what else to do with myself. I didn't want to stand there in front of him. We were silent for a few minutes as I worked with my back to him. I sensed him staring at me. "Anyway," he said, coughing, "I appreciate that this probably changes things. I've been ringing around. There's a place up the coast that will have me. Us. We'll go this afternoon. I just wanted to say how sorry I was, and that if there's anything I can do to, well, to mitigate the effects of this development, you should let me know." I paused, my duster raised in my hand, and turned to him. My voice, when it came, sounded unusually loud in the cavernous space. "How do you mitigate killing off a 70-year-old family business, Mike?" I asked. He looked shattered then, as I'd guessed he would. "You know what? I don't really give a fig about the hotel, no matter what you might think. Buildings as such don't hold a great deal of importance for me, and this one's been falling down for years. I'm not even that fussed about the bay. And the whales and the dolphins, I'm hoping that the busybodies who look out for them now will see they're okay." I shifted my weight, passed my duster into the other hand. "But there's something you should know, Mike Dormer. When you destroy this place, you destroy Hannah's safety. This is the one place she can be in all the world where she doesn't have to worry, where she can grow up safe and untouched. I can't explain more than that, but you should know it. Your actions will have an impact on our little girl, and for that, I can't forgive you." But why would you have to leave here? How can we afford to live in a hotel with no customers?" "Who says you'll have no customers? Your hotel is completely different from what's planned. There'll always be customers for a place like yours. When there are 150 rooms with en-suites and satellite television next door, and winter 3-for-2 offers and a heated pool indoors, I don't think so. The one thing we had going for us here was isolation. The kind of people who came here wanted to be in the middle of nowhere. They wanted to be able to hear the sea at night and the whisper of the grass on the dunes and nothing else. They didn't want to hear karaoke night in the humpback lounge and the sound of 48 cars reversing in and out of the car park on their way to the subsidised buffet. Come on, Mike, you deal in hard figures, in commercial research. You tell me how an operation like this stays afloat." He made as if to speak, then mutely shook his head. "Go back to your masters, Mike. Tell them you've done their bidding, you've sealed the deal, or whatever it is you city types say." I was close to tears, and this made me so furious that I had to start dusting again so he couldn't see my face. 76 years old, and about to cry like an adolescent girl. But I couldn't help it. Every time I thought about Liza and Hannah disappearing, about them having to settle somewhere far from here, having to start over, I got short of breath. I had half expected him to leave. I'd had my back to him for so long. But when I turned, he was still there, still staring at the floor, still thinking. At last, he raised his head. "I'll get it changed," he said. "I'm not sure how, Kathleen, but I'll put it right." I must have looked disbelieving because he took a step towards me. "I promise you, Kathleen, I'll put it right." Then he turned on his heel, hands deep in his pockets, and walked back up the path towards the house. The following day, I dropped Hannah at school, then took the inland road to see Nino Gaines. He was one of the few people with whom I could have an honest discussion about money. Trying to convey to Liza how little there was would have made her even more anxious, and I had always taken pains to disguise how little her whale-watching trips offset the costs of running our household.
"So, how much have you got?"
We were sitting in his office. From the window, I could see the rows of vines, bare now, like battalions of barren twigs under an unusually grey sky. Behind him, there were books on wine and a framed poster of the first supermarket promotion that had included his Shiraz. I liked Nino's office. It spoke of healthy business, innovation and success, despite his advanced years. I scribbled some figures on the pad in front of me and shoved it towards him. It may sound daft, but I was brought up to think it rude to discuss money, and even at my age I find it difficult to say out loud. "That's the pre-tax profits, and that's the rough turnover. We get by. But if I had to put on a new roof or anything like it, I'd have to sell the boat."
"That tight, eh?"
"That tight." Nino was pretty surprised. I think until that point he had assumed that, because my father was the big name in the area when we'd first met, I must still be sitting on some sizable nest egg. But, as I explained to him, it was 50 years since the hotel's heyday, and 10 years since the Silver Bay had had anything like a constant stream of guests. Taxes, building repairs, and the cost of looking after two extra people, one of whom required an endless supply of shoes, books and clothes, had put paid to what little I had set aside. Nino took a gulp of his tea. Earlier, Frank had brought us a tray complete with a plate of biscuits. That he had placed these on a lace doily made me cast a new look at Nino's remaining single son, although Nino seemed to believe the decorative touch was for my benefit.
"Do you want me to invest in the hotel so you could do a bit of renovation? Smarten up the rooms? Put in some satellite TV? I've had a good few years. I'd be glad to sink a few quid into something new."
He grinned.
"Diversification. That's what the old accountant says I should focus on. You could be my diversification."
"What's the point, Nino? You know as well as I do, once that monster goes up by the jetty, we'll be little better than a shed at the end of their garden."
"Can you not survive on the whale-watching money?
Surely Liza will be going out more often with more people around. Perhaps you could invest in another boat, get someone to run it for you." "But that's just it. She won't stay if there are more people. She gets nervous. She needs to be somewhere quiet." The words sounded feeble even to me. I had long since stopped trying to justify the apparent enigma that was my niece. We sat quietly as Nino digested this. I finished my tea and placed the cup on the tray. Then he leant forward over the desk.
"Okay, Kate. You know I've never stuck my nose in, but I'm going to ask you now."
His voice dropped.
"What the hell is Liza running from?"
It was then that the tears came, and I realized in horror that I couldn't stop them. The sobs wrenched my chest and shoulders as if I were suspended on jerking strings. I don't think I've cried like that since I was a child, but I couldn't stop. I wanted so badly to protect my girls, but Mike Dormer and his idiotic, deceitful plans had brought home to me how vulnerable they were, how easily our supposed sanctuary at the end of the bay could become so much matchwood. When I had composed myself a little, I looked at him. His smile was sympathetic, his eyes concerned.
Can't tell me, huh? I put my head into my hands. I guess it must be something pretty bad or you wouldn't be so shook up. You mustn't think badly of her, I mumbled through my fingers. A soft, worn handkerchief was thrust into them, and I mopped inelegantly at my eyes. No one has suffered more than she has. Don't you go fretting. I know what I've seen of your girls, and I know there isn't a malicious hair on either of their heads. I won't ask again, Kate. I just thought telling someone, whatever it is, might offer you a bit of relief. I reached out then and took his strong old hand. He held mine tightly, his huge knuckles atop mine, and I took great comfort from it, more than I had guessed I might. We sat there for some minutes, listening to the ticking of his mantelpiece clock, me feeling the alien warmth of his skin absorbed by my own hand. I realized I didn't want to go home. I didn't have the strength to reassure Liza, who was almost manic with anxiety. I didn't want to be nice to Mike Dormer and his fashion plate girlfriend and think of what they had done to me. I didn't even want to have to calculate their bill. I just wanted to sit in the still room in the silent valley and have someone look after me. You could come here. His voice was gentle. I can't, Nino. Why not? I told you I can't leave the girls. I meant you and the girls. Why not? Plenty of room. Close enough for Hannah to stay at her school if you didn't mind a bit of driving. Look at this big old house. These rooms would love to see youngsters again. The only thing keeping Frank here is that he doesn't want to leave me alone. I said nothing. My head was swimming. Come and live with me. We can set it up however you want. You in your own room, or... He was gazing at me intently, and, in his heavy-lidded eyes, I could see an echo of the cocky young airman of 50 years previously. I won't ask you again. But it would make us both happy, I know. And I'd help to protect the girls from whatever it is you're so worried about. Hell, I'm in the middle of bloody nowhere, you know that. Even the ruddy mailman can't find us half the time. I laughed, despite myself. As I said before, Nino Gaines has always been able to do that to me. Then his hold on my hand became tighter. I know you love me, Kath.